Wrote the two books that founded the pattern idea in architecture, A Timeless Way of Building and Pattern Language Towns, Buildings, Construction, which stemmed from the 1970s, gave a talk. He was invited by the object-oriented patterns people in the software community, which by the end of the 80s had been massive. And in 1996, he was invited to give a keynote speech at the... the idea, of course, was that people in software engineering had worked a lot on patterns, and some of them, probably not all of them, but quite a few, had had a look at the original sources and seen Alexander's work and were interested in what he thought would be the, what his comments would be on how software engineering had picked up on his patterns idea. So here we have an architect invited to a developer's conference, essentially. And that's an interesting mix to start with, and I think this made for one of the best keynote speeches probably ever at this conference. But what we'll notice is that Alexander takes quite a kind of like different position to what people would expect him to say, and his overall stance towards the software engineering patterns idea is fairly critical. He also outlines that he has moved on with his ideas, and Alexander started in the 60s with a very mathematical, rigorous approach to architecture, which if you read it as a computer scientist is actually kind of funny, because he is writing things where he, you know, at length explains things such as, I don't know, binomial numbers or mathematical equations of very simple nature, and tries to apply them to architecture, and tries to make a very rigorous mathematical model of architecture. This is something he wrote in his book that's called The Nature of Order, I believe. That was an early work that he did. And then he moved on to the pattern idea, which is kind of a little less formal, a little less rigorous in its mathematical treatment, but still has a very strong structure, and very rigid structure as how to present information. And then he has recently moved on to something even more esoteric, you could probably say, an even more abstracted and informal approach to explaining how good architecture is to be done. And that's a new series of books that he's brought out. So we see Alexander here giving a talk on a book that he had written 20 years ago that the software engineering community had started to pick up on 10 years ago. And by the time he wrote this, he had already moved on his own ideas to this, you know, even more abstract, even more philosophical approach to architecture. I want you to basically look for a couple of things, which are, what is he saying are the things that he thought software engineering community did a good job at picking up this idea? How did he think it applies well? And where are the things that he points out are differences between how software engineering works and how architecture works, and how the pattern language idea has been picked up in the two disciplines? So these two things, I think, are some of the major points that are going to come out of this talk. And he's also a great speaker, very charismatic, so I hope you'll enjoy that in talk.
Strange situation I find myself in. I sympathize with me. I'm addressing a room full of people, a hall, a football field full of people, and I don't know hardly anything about what all of you do. So, be nice to me. My association with you, if I can call it that, began. Oh, it must have been 2 or 3 years ago, somebody called me, a computer scientist called me and said, there were a group of people here in Silicon Valley that would pay $3,000 to have dinner with me. I thought, what the hell is this? And it took me some time to find out. I mean, over the last, I didn't really understand what had been going on. I'm now beginning to understand a little bit more of what you are doing in your field and the way in which it comes in part from some things that I've done. But when I faced the question of addressing you, and earlier, a few months ago, I faced a similar thing when I was asked to write an introduction to Richard Gabriel's book, and again, the question for me was, what in the world should I write about? What is there that I could say that would be of interest? And because I, in a way, started out in computers many years ago in the late 50s, this question became quite fascinating to me and quite absorbing. And at first I was given, I mean, Jim, for example, when he invited me, he was very friendly, and I said to him, look, what do you want me to talk about, and so forth. And he said, oh, no, it doesn't matter, just talk about anything, and because it's you, and because of the history of this pattern thing, people will find it interesting. So that was... So I thought, well, what should I really talk about? What is the connection between what I have done and I'm doing now in the field of architecture and what you are doing and trying to do in the field of computing? And in effect, what I'll do in the three-quarters of hour I've got here is to tell you where my thoughts went as I stepped through this and as I've been thinking about it during these last few months. And I ended up actually with something that may startle you and may you may find quite strange, but I'm not going to tell you what that is just yet. So I'm going to, in effect, I'm just going to do three things. I'm going to talk, first of all, about patterns and pattern languages, what I did about that, a few little points about problems that we encountered, why we did it, how we did it, and so forth. That's sort of a historical thing, really referring back to late 60s, early 70s. Then I'm going to summarize the theoretical framework which has evolved out of that, which is about to be published in a series of volumes collectively called The Nature of Order, which is a book that will be put out by Oxford University Press in a few months' time. And that is a fairly radical departure from what the pattern language and those theories contain, although it is consistent with them. That'll be the second thing, and I'll just try and sketch that out in the hope that there might be some carryover or that you might possibly find it interesting, even though, of course, I will have no way to directly apply this to your field when I tell you about it. And that's all roughly where I've got to is in spring of this year, those two steps in thinking about this, and then when I wrote the introduction for Richard Gabriel's book, that was really as far as I got. If I say what I'm doing, maybe some of you folks might find it interesting or be able to extrapolate. I couldn't really find that satisfying. And I felt that there is some more significant connection between your field and mine, or perhaps that there is. And the third thing I'll talk about is how I now perceive that connection. Obviously, I suppose those of you who know what I do, you know I'm an architect. And all of my life, I've spent trying to learn how to produce living structure in the world.
That means towns, streets, buildings, rooms, gardens, places which are themselves living or alive. And my sad assumption here is that for the most part, what we have been doing for ourselves, at least the last 50 years or so, perhaps starting somewhere around World War II, essentially has virtually no ability to produce that kind of living structure in the world. So as inhabitants, and as here we are in our daily life, but this living structure which is needed to sustain us and nurture us, and which did exist to some degree in traditional societies, and in rural communities, and in early urban settlements, has disappeared drastically. Now, of course, that's a debatable matter. Some people would say, what are you talking about? It's all absolutely fine. I suppose the architect of this particular room would say that. But actually, it isn't fine. It's a hell of a problem. It's a serious problem. It affects every man, woman, and child on Earth. And we are so ignorant about how to do this. It's lamentable, and it's very, very serious, because of course we're building, because the population of the Earth is growing, the way economic development works. Actually, already most of the habitable environment is something that has been built in these last 50 years. So the fact that we don't really know what we're doing, and the fact that it is not nurturing, is a very, very drastic matter for all of us. So anyway, that's my concern, that's what I try to deal with. And the initial ideas that materialized in the published pattern language was, first of all, of course, just to try and get a handle on some of the physical structures that might make the environment nurturing. And secondly, to do this in a way that would allow this to happen on a really large scale. And what I mean by that is, you know, architects build a very, very small part of the world. Most of the physical world is built, it's just built by all kinds of people. It's built by developers, it's built by do-it-yourselfers in Latin America, it's built by hotel chains, railroad companies, you know, etc., etc. How could one possibly get a hold of the massive amount of construction that is taking place on Earth and somehow let it be generated in a good fashion and in a living fashion? And this is not merely because of the scale problem, but also one of the characteristics of any good environment is that every part of it is extremely highly adapted to its particularities. In traditional society, where people by and large, for example, either built or laid out their own houses, their own streets and so on, the adaptation was natural. It occurred because it was in the hands of the people who were directly using it. So with the help of the kind of pattern language which existed in traditional society, they were able then to generate a complete living structure, because this local adaptation that had to happen here and here and here and here could happen because they all shared these languages. Now in our time, actually the production of the environment has largely gone out of the hands of people at large in society. And so one of the efforts of the pattern language was not merely to try and identify structural features which would make the environment positive or nurturing, but also to do it in a fashion which could be in everybody's hands, so that the whole thing would effectively then generate itself going forward. Now, my understanding of what you are doing with patterns and here I mean my comments taken with a grain of salt. I'm ignorant. I'm not in your field. But the way I, when I look at the work that I have seen, I see that the format of a pattern, context, problem, solution, and so forth, it's kind of a neat format. It allows you to write down, let's just call them good ideas, in a way that can be discussed, shared, modified, and so forth. So it's kind of a really useful vehicle of communication. And I think that insofar as patterns have become useful tools in the development design of programming languages by end of programs, it works that way. It is kind of a neat format, and that's fine. Now, the pattern language that we began did have other features, and I don't know whether those have translated over into your discipline. I mean, there was at root, behind the whole thing, a continuous moral preoccupation with under what circumstances is the environment good. And of course, in our field, that means something. I mean, it means something important, vital. And there are certainly plenty of people who will debate whether it's an objective question. I mean, some people are still going around saying it's all a matter of opinion. I think that's a dying breed, actually, the people who are going around saying that. But in any case, I don't know whether that sort of moral component exists in the way in which you've done things. I understand that the patterns, insofar as they refer to objects in programs and so on, they will make a program better. That isn't quite the same thing, because then the issue, again, if I'm translating from my experience, would be, well, do they go far enough so that the program or the thing that is being created is morally profound, actually has the capacity to play a more significant role in human life, a deeper role in human life, will actually make human life better as a result of its injection into the system. I don't pretend, by the way, that all of the patterns that we wrote down in a pattern language are like that. I mean, some of them are like that, and some of them are less so. But at least it was the constant attempt. That's what we were after. I don't know whether you are after that. I haven't heard a whole lot about that. So I have no idea whether that is what you're searching for, or are you only searching for a, what shall I call it, a technical performance that is good out of a program. That seems to me a very, very vital issue. People have said to me, well, how did you, meaning me and my colleagues, how did you create that pattern language that's in the book or other pattern languages? What kind of a process was involved? And one of the things that was constant throughout it was that as we came up with these things, we were able to judge them, tried to judge them, according to the extent that they, that when present in the environment, they really did make people more whole in themselves. Now you can say, well, how in the hell did you test for that? And that's a long story, which is not one I can deal with right here. But the point is, it was going on. And the second thing that was going on, when one had a language under development, there was an issue of to what extent does that language produce entities that are whole and coherent. In other words, suppose I write a pattern language for a campus, and I think I've got some sort of a language that looks like it will actually do the job. I can let it loose by giving it to people and say, look, generate a campus with this language. Let me see what it looks like. Well, you see what it looked like. Well, we tested ourselves. And many of the languages that one produces do not generate coherent objects. That is, they a bunch of good ideas, and one can sort of put something together, and a few fragmentary structural ideas will be present in the result. But we were always looking for that. We were always looking for the extent to which, as a whole, a pattern language would produce a coherent entity. And again, of course, one has, to some extent, criteria problems. How do you tell whether it's coherent, and so on and so forth? Again, a bit too long to go into, but the point is, that is what we were looking for all the time. And again, I have no idea to what extent that is true for you and whether you do that. So far, as a layman trying to read some of the works that have been published by you in this field, it looks to me more as though mainly the thing is kind of a neat format that is a good way of exchanging ideas about programming. And that part is working very well, but these other two dimensions, the moral capacity to produce a living structure and the generativity of the thing, that is, its capability of producing coherent wholes, I haven't seen very much evidence yet of those two things, but again, that could be just because I don't know how to read the literature. So that's sort of, that's my historical view of what we were doing with pattern languages and a little bit of a glance that I have had at what you do with these concepts. How am I doing for time generally? Good. Plenty of time. Now, I began to notice, I guess in the late 70s, two things about our work with the patterns and the pattern languages. Especially under the circumstances that I was interested in, which was where others were using these patterns to generate buildings. The buildings were okay, but not profound. There was often a lot of neat stuff going on in them. People were improving certain features. Perhaps the daylight was improved, or perhaps the entrance of a building might be improved, or the characteristics of a street might be improved, or an alcove in a bedroom might make it more intimate, or something like this. But so there were various isolated features that were very definitely improvements and allowed people to feel that they had control over their own environment and succeeded in embodying that control in the real buildings that they made with this material. So that was good. But nevertheless, were they profound structures? To what extent did they really have this living substance that I've spoken of? And I must say, this is late 70s, and I had really begun to see the results and begun to see the kind of things that were happening out there in the world when this stuff was applied. And I was not happy with what I saw. I felt that we had fallen very far short of the mark that I had intended. But I also realized that whatever was going wrong or was not adequate wasn't going to be corrected by writing a few more patterns or making the patterns a little bit better. There seemed to be something more fundamental that was missing. So I started looking for what that thing was. The The other thing that happened around that same time, was that I began to notice that there were a small number of structural characteristics that appeared to exist recursively in space, and that were sort of the more fundamental stuff that the patterns were made of. These were very simple ideas. I mean, I can name some of them very simply. Levels of scale, or positive space, or alternating repetition. One or two a little bit mysterious, one called the void, so forth. And there's 15 of these things, but that I began to notice that the particulars that were being gathered together in various particular individual patterns seemed really to come always from these 15 or so deep properties that kept occurring again and again and again. Now, the other thing that was happening around this time, this is the late 70s, early 80s, is that my colleagues and I, began toughening up our ability to discriminate between more living structure and less living structure. That is, at the time of doing the pattern language, we'd really been rather intuitive about that and not very rigorous. And we were just trying to be, just trying to do the job, in some intuitive sense. But at this point, we felt it was pretty important to try to get a fix on, well, what is the difference between a chair which has a more living structure and a chair that has a less living structure? Or the same for a doorknob, or the same for a main street in a town, or large structures and small, in other words. But the question is, if you want to say this one has life, this one has less life, can you say that with any degree of accuracy? Can it in fact be made a relatively objective matter, which people will agree about if they perform the same experiments? And we did find such techniques, such experimental techniques. And the use of them greatly sharpened our ability to distinguish, well, okay, so what was really going on, and which structures then correlated with the presence of life in an object or in a bit of the environment? And so these 15 properties that I've mentioned, that were sort of the substrate of the patterns we had discovered, began showing up more and more clearly as the main correlates of this living structure in places, buildings, things, outdoor space, and so forth. I need to say a word about the kinds of criteria. When I say, well, yes, we did find objective criteria, because you've got to understand, in my discipline, where the tremendous vested interest among architects, that there is no such thing as truth, because everybody wants to do their own damn stupid thing, and get away with it. So, depending on who you talk to, they'd say, well, this stuff Alexander's been telling is a lot of horseshit. There is no such thing as objectivity about this and so forth. But anyway, I'm here today and they're not here, so I'm telling you that there is such a thing. Now, the nature of these experiments is very peculiar, in a way. Because what the experiments ask, Let's suppose that we were trying to, we got a sidewalk somewhere, a bit of a street, and we got another sidewalk, another bit of a street, and we're trying to come to conclusions about which one is a more living structure. And my belief, by the way, and I probably should start with this, I mean, when I began trying to find these experimental methods, my belief always was that there really is such a thing, and that actually everybody kind of knows it, but that it has been suppressed. That is, because of the worldview that we have and the way of looking at things and the nervousness about intellectual rigor, that in a way people, though they have these judgments within them, somehow are separated from their ability to make these judgments correctly. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, and this is just with the sort of instinct that I had going in, was that this is something childish, really, that everybody knows, but for some reason we're so messed up that we can't see it. And so these experiments were, in effect, designed to penetrate that and cut through it. The essence of these experiments is that you take the two things that you're trying to compare and ask, for instance, is my wholeness increasing in the presence of this object or in the presence of this one, and is it more or less? And you might say, well, strange question, I mean, what if the answer is don't know or don't have any effect and so forth? Perfectly reasonable that that could happen. What turns out to happen is that if you say, well, yes, it's a difficult question, it kind of sounds a little bit nutty, but anyway, please humor me and answer the question. Then it turns out, first of all, that there is quite striking agreement. It's like not 100%, but very strong. A strong agreement as one gets in a lot of scientific experiments of other kinds. And that the really strange part is that the things which are measured by experiments of that sort are not, you see, it's sort of, all of these different experiments have to do with something like that. Do you feel more whole? Do you feel more alive in the presence of this thing? Do you feel that this one is more a picture of your own true self than this thing? You know, whatever. Always looking at two entities of some kind and comparing them as to which one has more life. It appears to be a rank bit of subjectivity. In other words, it sounds like, well, okay, fine, I mean, maybe this is a truth about human beings, in the sense about our cognition or about our perception or about our feelings, but that's not necessarily the same as saying living structure as such is a real thing that resides in those objects. But anyway, to cut a long story short, it turns out that these kind of measurements do correlate with real structural features in the thing and with the presence of life in the thing, measured by other methods, so that it isn't just some sort of subjective, I groove to this and I don't groove to that and so on, but it is a way of measuring a real deep condition in the particular things that are being compared or looked at. And what's odd about this, and in a way as our work went further and further, kept bringing big practical matters always back to the human person. So in other words, you take a parking lot. There's lots of technical problems in a parking lot. I mean, it's got to work, cars have got to be able to move around, there's security problems, there's in and out problems, there's not very complicated ones, but I mean anyway, it's essentially a technical thing, and the question is, okay, is it working well or not well? And yet, the functionality of the thing, measured by various ordinary bits of technical discussion, correlates with this condition of, do I feel myself to be more whole when I am in this parking lot, let's say, as compared with that one? or even in engineering design, for instance, where one has the structural behavior of a bit of a bridge, or the patterns of movement in something where a lot of people are walking about and there's sort of complicated questions about how they move and so forth. I mean, very, very practical matters are nevertheless correlated with these very personal questions about whether the thing has life, whether it promotes life in me and you. So there began to be developing, in my views on this, a view of structure, which at the same time that it was objective and it was about structures that are out there in the actual thing, is somehow coming home more and more and more all the time into the person. Because
interesting point here. Without him referring to this, this actually starts linking into HCI quite a lot. Because what he just said is basically, well, we have functional features of, say, a parking lot, you know, how easy it is to move in, how easy it is to park, whether you get lost or whatever, whether you get stuck because others are trying to move out while you're trying to move in, all these things. What he's saying is, are, you know, relatively simple questions, but they are problems that need to be addressed. And these functional features, as he puts it in his, you know, esoteric way of saying it, relate to whether people feel, you know, alive and whole and so on when they are inside that environment. Now, if you think about this from a little more practical HCI point of view, what he's describing is essentially usability and, you know, the pleasure of using something. Because you could say you are a user, basically, of the parking lot as a functional structure, and it has a certain user interface, which starts by, you know, getting your ticket when you get in, and then, you know, finding the next empty spot, and so on. And all these things basically are designed as an interface to this parking structure. And you're using it, you're basically a user of this environment, and you have a certain satisfaction using it, or maybe not. Maybe it's a pleasure to use it, or maybe it is not. So you take these examples of some parking lots these days have little green arrows telling you where the, you know, where there are still empty spots. You don't need to circle through all those empty, you know, levels of a parking garage, for example. Simple functional things, but they improve what you could call the user experience of something such as a parking lot. So, you know, whenever he talks about wholeness and liveness, which sounds like, you know, right out of some, you know, alternative, I don't know, community video or something. It sounds very off and esoteric. Just replace that with thinking usability and ease of use and, you know, a positive user experience. And you have a lot of things that will relate very closely to what we're trying to do. Just, you know, right now he's talking to a bunch of software developers down there who have, you know, a very limited view of usability and user-centered design and thinking about the user experience. So I think this is a great talk, just, you know, probably given to an audience that really needs it. But his like-minded people are not the ones he's talking to right there. His like-minded people would have been at a conference such as Kai. People who are thinking about the user experience and about the UI. And he's now, by the way, starting to talk about these fundamental properties, which are the things that he talked about in this new series of books that he released, The Nature of Order. It's funny also to hear him say, these are going to be out in a couple months. This is 96. I think the first book appeared, I think, in 2003 or something. So it took them much longer to actually get those out. But they're out now. They describe those fundamental properties.
Some peculiar fashion with the condition in ourselves when we are in the presence of that thing. And just to go a little bit further than that, what it meant was that the objects that are most profound, or again, when I say object, I mean, you know, again, building, street, doorknob, shelf, room, dome, bridge, whatever. The objects that are the most profound, functionally, are the ones which also promote the greatest feeling in us. Now that's a very peculiar thing, because of course if you just hear that cold at first sight, it sounds like rank sentimentality, and you just say, well, it can't be true. Why should it be true? And yet it's a discovery which accords very well with the times, because we are living in a period where that is perhaps the most noticeable and most problematic feature of our world, is that feeling has been removed from it. When I make a joking reference to this room, without going on beating a dead horse, but I mean, really the problem is that there is, that the, whatever feeling there is in here is obviously not a profound feeling, and the failure of that profound feeling to exist in the world around us, at small scales, large scales, middle scales, here, there, and everywhere, is tragic. It's the thing that we miss. And of course, people have been writing about this, well, for many decades. I mean, writers have been, have of course made this known. We all know it. The difficulty is that people don't seem to know what to do about it. And if anything, at the moment, I'm talking now again about my own discipline, I mean that of architecture, but the problem is really getting worse. It's not getting better. The world that is being built is more unfeeling. We are, in a sense, more lost, more fragmented, more sort of wandering about in this lonely desert than before. So that if there is a way of looking at structures which both deals with real functional structure in the ordinary technical and practical sense, and simultaneously has its roots or its origin in this question of human feeling, that will be a very huge and positive step. It is a very peculiar intellectual development. And I mean, I need to stress that the apparatus within which these kind of things that I'm talking about here are true or are made visible and look reasonable is quite complex and somewhat unfamiliar. So it is actually a slightly different worldview from the one that we are currently engaged in. In particular, just going back to these 15 properties that I mentioned and the ability to be precise about the nature of a living structure. At the root of these 15 properties, there appears to be a recursive structure with only one type of entity. This entity, in my own current writings about it, I call them centers. One might, I suppose, probably call them a lot of things, and I think there may even be, at a stretch, a little bit of a connection with some of the things that you call objects. These centers are in effect field-like structures that appear in some region. They don't have a sharp boundary, but they are the sort of focal organizing entities that one perceives, and within the view that I'm putting forward here, and that I've gradually come to in this last decade and a half, everything is made of these kind of centers. The centers are more living or less living, and that's essentially the only important property that they have. And the question of whether a center is more living or less living depends recursively on the amount of livingness in the other centers that it is made of, because each center is actually a structure of other centers. And since many of you are quite comfortable with mathematical thoughts, that sort of recursion is fairly familiar in this field that you have. But it is, anyway, at the core of this thing that I'm speaking about. Now, whether this would translate in any interesting way to things that you do, I don't know. I can't say. There's no way I could speculate about it. What is true, I can tell you from my own experiences and that of my colleagues in these last years, is that when one has that view of things, it becomes enormously easier to produce living structure. So that it has immediate practical carryover. If you start understanding everything in terms of these living centers, and you recognize the recursion that makes a center living or less living, or more living, dependent on the other centers that it is made of and the other larger centers in which it is embedded, suddenly you begin to get a view of things which almost in and of itself starts leading you towards the production of the more living structure. It's a much more powerful and beautiful view than was embodied in the pattern languages, because when one has constructed this view and then you say, well, now what is a pattern really? You look back at that sort of thing, and then it turns out that patterns are merely a few of the structural invariants that appear within these centers under very, very particular conditions. So they're certainly interesting and important, but they don't have the same depth or the same universal character as these other things that I'm speaking about now. And it's because they're only really fragmentary perceptions of this deeper structure that I'm describing, that they are ultimately unsatisfactory, I think, and not capable of delivering the goods. Now, I'm still now talking about my sort of part two of my talk here, part two of my speech, which is this work loosely labeled The Nature of Order and the books that I've been writing about that. If one has identified living structure with a reasonable level of objectivity, and if one has identified this recursive center-based structure as being the key to the whole thing, all that's all very well. But then, of course, the practical question arises, how the hell do you produce this living structure? What do you have to do to actually produce it? You can recognize it and talk about it. You can clumsily try to find your way towards it in a particular case. But in general, what are the rules of its production? Now, the answer to this, I'm going to summarize extremely briefly, but it is fascinating and it's of great importance, and it will lead me on in a way to my part three. It turns out that these living structures can only be produced by an unfolding wholeness. That is, there's a condition in which you have space in a certain state, you operate on it through things that I have come to call structure-preserving transformations, maintaining the whole at each step, but gradually introducing differentiations one after the other. And if these transformations are truly structure preserving and structure enhancing, then you can come out at the end with living structure. Very abstract, I know, but the punchline is the following. Number one, that is what happens mainly in the living structures we think of as nature. When you analyze carefully just what's going on and how things are happening in the natural world, this sort of structure-preserving transformations tends to be what's going on most of the time, which is why, when nature being left alone, one recognizes, by and large, living structure is being produced. In the approaches that we currently have to the creation of the environment, that is to planning of buildings, planning of towns, construction of buildings, and so forth, that is simply not what is happening. the process of design that we currently recognize as normal is one where, whether it's an architect or somebody else, is sort of moving stuff around, trying to get into some kind of good configuration. Boom, you know, here's the good configuration, and then here's a set of drawings of this good configuration, and now we're going to build this good configuration, so on. But in fact, since it isn't unfolding step by step in the structure preserving way that I'm talking about, the result is never a living structure. And it's not too difficult, in effect, to, well, I perhaps exaggerated a little bit, but I'll just call it anyway, you write theorems which say, under the kind of conditions which are current in the construction industry today, you cannot produce living structure. So the poor son of a bitch that did this thing was stuck with it. There was nothing he could do, or she, because it was part of the process by which this kind of entity is produced in today's society, that it cannot come out with a living structure at the end. Now that is a shattering discovery. And so a very large part of my work and that of my colleagues in the last, in these immediate last years, has been one of trying to define social processes, economic processes, administrative and management processes, which are of such a nature that they permit true unfolding to occur in society. And then actually trying to make these things happen. I mean, this is what we do, what I do most of the time, is I'm trying to do real projects of one sort or another, where I'm introducing this unfolding process and trying to make it work under the conditions available to us in 1996. The shifts involved are gigantic. That is, the shifts in thought, in practice, in administration of money, in contracts, all sorts of real nitty-gritty things that in a way one would much rather not mess with. You have to mess with, because it is those processes which are undermining the ability for this whole thing to be structure-preserving, unfolding. So this involves very, very big changes, changes that are not only very big but very difficult to implement. But, in my view, absolutely necessary. So that's roughly the end of my second section. Now, some of the people who were kind enough to invite me have in effect assured me that if I just sort of spill this kind of stuff out, that there'll be those among you that somehow might latch onto it or know how to translate it into something that's more directly relevant to your own concerns. And I suspect that's likely, given where you've been with pattern languages. And in a way, when I came to the end of writing Richard Gabriel's foreword, and struggling with that, this is about as far as I'd got. That is, okay, so here are some of the more recent things that we've been doing. This is what they're like. This is the nature of them. They may be relevant to you folks, conceivably. I can't tell. It's up to you to tell. So forth. Anyway, that's all sort of pretty thin, but that's about where I was somewhere in the spring of this year. How much time have I got now? I started thinking about a couple of things that then led me to feel that there was a possible coincidence in what you are doing and what I'm doing, where they might merge. You'll probably think I'm off my head by the time I get done with this next section, but that's all right. First of all, let me just explain where I am in my own life in regard to these problems. I've been telling you things that I think are important, or discoveries in some ways. As an architect, of course, like anybody concerned with those things, I have a passion to try and make these things happen. It's not enough just to say, well, living structure isn't being produced. I have to ask myself the question, I do ask myself the question all the time, okay, well, what are we going to do about it? Here we've got this poor earth sinking under the weight of all this dross, and what are we actually going to do? Now, you know, I do a $10 million project here, and I do a $10 million project there, and, you know, life is short. I mean, a few of those projects, and what is it? I mean, it's an atom in the proverbial bucket. It's nothing. All of the efforts of the architectural brethren, even if I could persuade them of the truth of these things, which is happening, but rather slowly, it's a drop in the bucket. The total amount of built stuff on Earth is something on the order of about 10 to the 12th, 10 to the 13th square feet of construction. Manhattan is somewhere on the order of 10 to the 9th. And if you include all the exterior space, the part that's somehow having to do with human beings, and it is part of our immediate world, whether we're talking about gardens and streets and agriculture and all of that, then we're somewhere up around 10 to the 15th, 10 to the 16th square feet. When I started out 25 years ago, 30 years ago, I really thought that I was going to influence that stuff fast. Especially when I got to the paddle language, I thought, boy, I've really done it. I mean, this is going to work. No problem. I've done nothing. Nothing. I mean, this is all nice talk, you know, and there's a few people have learned a few things and been influenced, but I mean, meanwhile, we've got this gigantic amount of construction out there, which is the world that all of us live in, that is still going on in exactly the same fashion. I believe that the cultural process of influence is simply too slow to be able to take care of this problem. In other words, the process by which one sort of discusses these kind of things, shares ideas about them, gradually influences the way people are thinking so that hopefully gradually larger and larger percentages of bits of the environment might turn into living structure. That is a very slow process, and I don't think it is fast enough to do the job. And yet I view myself as responsible for that. I mean, I don't mean alone, I mean, but as a professional, that's my job, is to try to understand how we can get hold of that and do something about it. So I'm sitting there thinking to myself, right, I'm going to talk to people who are in a way the core of the computer revolution. You probably realize, I'm not actually sure you do, given a couple of breakfast conversations, but I would think you would realize the extent to which the world is gradually now being shaped more and more and more, indirectly, by the efforts of all of you that are sitting in this room. Computers.
So this is getting to an interesting point, more or less pointing out, well, patterns are great in architecture, but you know, changing that process is way too slow because we're talking about real physical buildings and all this established, you know, decades old or hundreds of thousands of years old practice of building real environments that has kind of decayed into a not very, you know, livable environment that's being created. But computer science is currently creating those virtual environments that we're living in or that we're interacting with, essentially the virtual worlds that people find themselves in a lot of times these days. And he'll be pointing out some ideas how he thinks maybe, you know, he's had some great ideas. It's too late to work in the real world of architecture, but maybe they can carry over to the world of, if you like, virtual architecture. And again, he's talking to software engineers. We're not really shaping this direct experience of the virtual environment, but you know, if you take that over to HCI, if you take that over to thinking about the user experience, how that should be designed, that's an interesting parting thought that he's sharing with us, that maybe this can carry over to our profession.
Programs, I should really say, it's not the computers, it's the programs. Control the shape of manufacturing, the shape of the transportation industries, construction management, diagnosis in medicine, printing and publishing. You almost can't name a facet of the world which is not already, to some very strong degree, under the influence of the programs that are being written to manage and control those entities or those operations. I know this is in its infancy. It's going to look a whole lot different. Given, I mean, how long has this really been going on? Not more than about 10 or 15 years. Of course, the preparation for it goes back a lot further than that. But really, this is quite new. And yet, as a body, I don't think that you, and I'm probably totally speaking out of turn here, I just don't know. But it seems to me, at least, you know, I've found through the proceedings of this conference, for instance, which Jim was kind enough to give me yesterday, I don't really see discussion about what are we supposed to be doing with all these programs. How are they supposed to help the Earth? And yet, the capacity to do that is sitting right here in this room. I mean, that is an amazing situation. When I had the pleasure of beginning to meet some of the various folks who introduced themselves to me over the last year and a half from this community, I began to be fascinated by the number of them that were sort of closet architects. I mean, you know, this person is really interested in ecology and is an editor of an ecological magazine. Bill Joy is writing about workstations in the concrete physical sense that is familiar to me as an architect. Jim Copeland is dealing with social structures, that is the actual social structures in organizations. I don't know a long enough list, but my hunch, my sort of sense of it is that an amazing number of you who got into this pattern game in the pursuit of your normal professional endeavors are also very profoundly interested in the real physical world, that is, in the world in which we inhabit. Now, it is conceivable that you collectively could change the very drastic situation that I described a minute ago. Let me just go back to the unfolding for a moment. I talked about these structure-preserving unfolding processes. Compared with the pattern language of mine that you've seen in the book, that you, some of you have, in more recent times, my colleagues and I have written things that are much more like what you call code. They're generative processes which are more like sets of instructions that produce the things. They are actually sets of instructions which allow the unfolding to occur in space in just the way that I was talking about a minute ago, and therefore are capable of producing living structure. The published pattern language, by comparison, is rather static. You know, it consists of these objects which are interesting and which you somehow try to mush together. But it's possible to have processes or procedures which will actually generate living structure. Because of the complexity of the situation, because of the way software is going, software that was designed to do that could very rapidly take the world by storm. You've probably heard the sort of, you know, it's a sort of familiar thing in the history of the development in technical change. Very often, the people responsible for a certain specialty are then followed by a technical innovation, and then the people that are responsible after the technical innovation is a completely different group of people. For instance, I mean, this is the old saw, you know, that the people who built the buggies for the horse and buggy did not then turn into Henry Ford. Henry Ford and the people that were building automobiles came from left field and then took over, and the horse and buggy died off. It is conceivable to imagine a future in which this problem of generating the living structure in the world is something that you would explicitly recognize as part of your responsibility. Now, this is a kind of level of marriage between you and me that is of an entirely different sort from the one that I was invited to contemplate. I was effectively brought here to say, okay, what new things you've been doing, Chris, that might spin off and be useful to us, you know, in our neck of the woods. And my parts one and two were about that. But my part three is about something quite different. I want you to help me. I want you to realize that that problem of generating living structure is not being handled by architects or planners or developers or construction people now. There is no way that they're ever going to actually be able to do that because the methods they use are not capable of it. The methods that you have at your fingertips and deal with every day in the normal course of it are perfectly designed to do this. So that if you have the interest, you have the capacity and you have the means. I heard a rumor at breakfast that some of the people in this room begin to worry about their jobs. I have no idea if that's true. But I was told there's a sort of undercurrent of unease of where is all this going? There's this huge expanding phenomenon, programming and so forth, and yet an uneasiness about, well, where is it all headed? What is it going to do? Please forgive me, I'm going to be very directly blunt for a horrible second. But it could be viewed that the technical way in which you look at programming at the moment is almost like guns for hire. In other words, you're the technicians, you know how to make the programs work, Tell us what to do, Daddy, and we'll do it. And what I'm proposing here is something a little bit different from that, which is a view of programming as the natural genetic infrastructure of a living world, which you are capable of creating, managing, making available, and which could then have the result that a living structure in our towns, houses, workplaces, cities, is an attainable thing, which it has not been for the last 50 to 100 years. That is an incredible vision of the future. I realize that you probably think I'm nuts, because this is not what I'm supposed to be talking about to you. And you may say, well, gosh, great idea, but we're not interested. But I do think you are capable of that. And I don't think anybody else is going to do this job. I've enjoyed talking to you very much. Thank you.
Architecture. Before we head out, I'd like to just spend a couple minutes to summarize what we've heard. And, see what you thought about those ideas. Anything that did strike you in the discussion? Any things that you found strange? Yeah.
What I found interesting was what he was talking about when he used the example with the parking lot, that there are certain aspects of this that are rather technical, like you have to get in and out of it, and other aspects that address more aspects like usability, like you have to like using the parking lot, which kind of reminds me of some stuff which was in some papers I've recently read, because a lot of people, when they were doing usability studies, didn't just focus on how was the task performance or how efficient were the use algorithms, but how much did the users like it? How much did they think it was fun to use or easy to learn? More put back this feeling aspect in usability. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if this is what he meant, but at least that was what he reminded.
So first of all, that's an important level of usability, and usually you find the three big measurements that people generally do is, if they do usability studies, is time on task, how long does it take the person to complete it, which is very technical and very hard measurement. Then there's error rates, how many mistakes do people make. That's also a very technical thing to measure, although this becomes harder to measure because what's an error and what's a big mistake, small mistake. And the third thing that people often like to look at is user satisfaction. And there are actually situations in which those two can be not consistent. A great example is Bruce Tognazzini talks about this in Talk on Interface in one of his books. He says, if you ask people who don't have keyboard shortcuts available, and they're using the mouse to select things, they're okay, they're using this stuff, and then you give them keyboard shortcuts. Let's say you have a drawing program where people draw stuff, and for the keyboard shortcut they actually have to leave the mouse alone and move over and use the keyboard shortcut. They oftentimes find themselves feeling that they're quicker, that it's more effective to do that. So if you ask them after the fact, they all say, using the keyboard shortcuts in this graphics program was more effective, I was faster to do my work. And he had some occasions in which he measured this, actually, and people were slower. So what was happening was that, since this was a graphics intensive application, people were using the mouse all the time, drawing stuff. Now, if they had to select a menu, let's say, they had to, you know, consciously move the mouse over there, you know, have the menu drop down, select the thing from the menu bar. That's a, you know, that's a, you could say a Fitts' law task, if you like, but it's a very obvious and punching, you know, something that you do consciously. Using the keyboard shortcut meant that you had to leave your mouse alone and move your hands over to the keyboard. This was not one of those designs where you could use your keyboard shortcuts in one hand and use the mouse in the other. So you had to actually do a, you know, change your device operation. But this was something that people didn't regard as part of the task. They didn't look at this as, you know, this is taking time. So they were moving their hands from the mouse to the keyboard, and this was basically something where they were so busy doing this that they didn't realize that time was passing. Once they were there, they were could, you know, immediately and very quickly select this one keyboard shortcut, which seemed much more effective than going down this lengthy menu, you have to drop down and select the right item. And then they had to go back to their mouse and pick up their work again. But those, you know, homing operations, as Carter and his colleagues called it in the beginning, were not registering with the users as time spent. So here you have something that actually takes longer to do, but people are happier doing it because they feel it's faster. So, you know, which part should you believe? Which part should you fill in? You know, what's the right way to go? So the emotional aspect, let's say, user satisfaction in a very simplistic term, is an important part of what you look at in usability, definitely. And you've just looked at Norman's emotional design book, which is all about this, talking about those different levels that you have. Of course, this cognitive usability aspect that we've been talking about at length in DIS-1, where you look at how long does this take, you know, how much is the memory load, and so on. But there are these two other levels, the one below it, which is this visceral level of, I just love touching my iPod, it's just a great design, I just like to hold it, and whatever. You know, things that you just feel are designed nicely, and they're just a pleasure to use from a physical standpoint. And then the level above that, which is, you know, sometimes you use things which are not really usable or easy to use, but you just use them because by using them you create a social environment or a social process that you appreciate. A great example is, you know, carrying around a big fat expensive needs to be wound up every day Rolex. You don't carry that because the watch is very useful, or maybe not even because the design is very visceral or very, you know, pleasing, but just because the social process of others seeing you wearing a Rolex is important to you. And there are many other examples of this kind of stuff happening. So yes, the emotional level of design, both in the sense of the social role that you find yourselves in, and both on the very visceral, you know, physical aspect of interacting, is important. What I think Alexander was trying to get at, though, is not so much that there are these two different levels, but he was actually trying to point out that by taking care of the usability design of, let's say, for example, you can actually end up creating a pleasurable user experience. So he was pointing out these two different areas, but he was also saying that they can be linked together. And that relates to his pattern view. He says, you know, apply those patterns to the structural layout of your space that you're designing, and what will emerge are social patterns of behavior that people enjoy, or people feel alive, where they like to be, what they like to use as an environment. So they're linked together potentially. Anything else?
That was very interesting how he kept referring to how he felt his patterns had a moral aspect.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't quite connecting with that train of thought, but I thought it was interesting how this notion of these patterns are designed to give back to humanity. You know, he has this very high view of how much impact his patterns are having. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and we talked about this earlier, saying that, you know, pattern languages are all about values. Mm-hmm. They always include a value system, and looking at Alexander's patterns clearly, you know, shows that he has certain values that he appreciates. Structures and people may disagree with those, but he also I think pointed out that he actually thought there was not that much carryover, and that he in this last part three of the talk, where he was talking about, you know, how he saw a new link towards the computing industry and the computing profession. Maybe there's not enough time in the whole business of architectural construction. It's just too slow to be changed according to these rules. So I think he was actually agreeing that his patterns were not having that much impact as he would like them to have. Although if they are applied, yes, they do change how people feel. Yeah.
Isn't that morality what you refer to as the quality of our mind?
No, I don't think so. I think quality without a name is something that you experience as a user of an environment, be it an architectural environment or a virtual environment, a computer science user interface, whatever. That's a quality that's inside this building. The moral aspect of it is to feel morally responsible as a designer, as an architect, as a user interface creator. To feel morally responsible for creating interfaces that help better, you know, humanity or the state of affairs.
That happens.
Yeah. Yes, you could say yes. The moral aspect of pattern languages in this view in this school is to create environments that have that quality without a name. The same thing, but you know, one is the responsibility to create something that has this other. Yeah.
Now, for me, it was quite interesting that he actually discovered that the whole process of building or constructing a building actually shapes the outcome. So he says that with some methods you simply can't do good design.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the same in software industry. If you think that you have a very tight schedule. And everybody's just talking about the technical terms that have to be fulfilled by a certain time, then nobody will concentrate on doing them well, but on just fulfilling them somehow. So they concentrate on these technical aspects and do not have time to look at the outcome as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think this... I thought it was really interesting when you said, you know, there are some aspects of the process, the building process, that you would prefer not to mess with, you know, the nitty-gritty details of the building process. And we all know that part, right? There are so many things where we just say, yeah, this toolkit sucks, or, you know, using this part of the development process is not a good idea, but that's just what's around, and we're not going to change that, because then we never get anywhere. So you constantly make, of course, you know, these little compromises in using the environments that you have. You're like, oh well, if I don't do this using, you know, the Microsoft Foundation class, then I won't be able to sell it on Windows, and so I'll just use it. It's not great, but we'll have to do that. So yeah, there are a lot of examples where I think we face the same problems. Yeah.
On a more didactical point of view, it's kind of interesting that you really want to bring over the message, to communicate, to criticize, in a way. But he was really careful in doing so. So he kind of followed what you said in the writer's workshop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He tried also to point out good things,
mm-hmm.
or that he thought that were good things. And he also always commented that it's probably just a dumbass, not knowing anything,
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But just being careful.
Yeah,
reminded me of you talking about the writer.
Right. Trying to wrap it into something nicer. Although I think, towards the end, it's getting more and more like a big whiplash into, you know, the face of the computing profession. In particular, you know, towards the end, where he says, like, it seems to me that you guys are basically doing guns for hire, which essentially means, you know, we'll develop anything that you tell us to do, whether it's, you know, whatever. System to control nuclear missiles or something, you know, that helps humanity.
Well, but in the sentence before, he also says that no, we're going to ease it off.
Right. He's warning his audience. That's right. That's a good technique. Also, while we're about, you know, the style of presentation, I've hardly ever seen a person that had the guts to not say anything for that long time that he leaves gaps in his speech. But it does work, right? everybody's sitting there and he's just taking his time to continue. So I think that's something to learn from this style of presentation, is rambling on and trying to fill every single second with a word so that nobody, you know, loses time is not a good idea all the time. Okay, any other comments? If not, then thanks for hanging out here today and listening to that presentation, which I think is very interesting. So you'll probably all go away morally supported now and on a new level, and knowing that you won't be doing guns for hire and using case design. I'll see you next time. Thanks.